Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 294 featuring Maciek Kuchara, who is an amazing concept artist and director and has worked at some incredible places, including Naughty Dog, etc., etc., and has done some really great, great, great work. Kristen, what did you think of Maciek?
Oh, it was such a lovely story. You know, just starting off behind the Iron Curtain to landing his like dream job of Ghost in the Shell, or one of his dream jobs.
Right.
And he left Naughty Dog for that, like a good job to, you know, pursue another career path. So the whole story is awesome. And then Showtime, which is, you guys talk about that. It's what he just did, posted it last month. And just the story behind that and the time.
Yeah. And I think Henry's writing a story behind about Showtime as well. So we're going to be talking, it's out there. Mm-hmm. So it's on our blog post or on our website. So you should go check it out. He is obviously, he has a passion for anime and it really loves that style and a lot of things that's going on there. And so he created a fantastic little short. And I won't call it little because it's not that little, but he did a short that has influenced him about, you know, the kind of stuff that he likes. And he did it in V-Ray, in a non-photoreal V-Ray. So the very anime looking stuff. And it was really great to see that. And his style really comes across, and he's got a lot of influence. He also does his own podcasting and stuff. So he's obviously very much influenced in that. Where I also just love how sweet he is. Like his demeanor is just a very, very sweet person.
And with his little girl in the podcast.
Yeah. And his daughter, who's, you know, we're all working with our kids in Zoom school, as we call it. And they're, you know, she was there, but she was great to be part of that. Mm-hmm. So it was really nice to have him on board, and great stuff. And I expect to do a lot of cool work with Maciek in the future, because you'll notice how much we get into how we get passionate about things, which is cool. Cool. Kristen, we have a couple of announcements. What's going on right now?
Yes. So you can find these out at chaosgroup.com/events. The first one is, it's actually going on right now. It started September 17th and it will be going till October 13th. And it's just it's a series with discovering the power of V-Ray 5. So there's a lot of exclusive presentations and you can sign up for those online. And then we have the Illumination Challenge, and that is the student rendering challenge. And the deadline is November 30th.
Which is coming up fast.
Yeah, gonna come a lot sooner than we think. And so you can enter our student rendering challenge and be in a chance to win V-Ray or Corona licenses and Chaos Cloud credits. So
perfect.
Very fun.
And we also have just to let you guys know, GTC is coming up, which is the GPU Technology Conference. Their fall event is happening. It's online, as you probably know. And we will be presenting several things there. But I definitely recommend you guys go check it out. Our event is happening on Thursday, October 8th, between 7 and 7:50 Pacific time. And we are presenting all of the cool work that we've been doing on V-Ray GPU. And there's a lot of stuff going on there. And that is not just for V-Ray GPU, but it's also for Lavina. So if you want to know what's going on our GPU side of things, it would be a good place to go. So Phil is going to be presenting along with Alex, who is our lead developer on the GPU side of things. Really fun to see that. So go check out the GTC conference. In terms of our product announcements, we've got V-Ray 5 for Houdini Beta is out. So you go make sure if you want to sign up for that. By the time this podcast intro happening, and I'm gambling, but I am saying that it's going to happen on Monday, 99% chance. V-Ray 5 for Cinema 4D beta will be available, and you guys should totally check it out. It's been in very high demand, so go check it out. V-Ray 5 for C4D, definitely have that available too. And then Phoenix FD4 Update 3 is also available if you want to do that. So that's all of our product stuff going on. If people want to find out more about the podcast itself, Kristen, where can they go?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. And if you guys have any other ideas if you want to do on the podcast, and we have been, like I said, we've been getting some emails and we've been definitely recording these podcasts. And if we think it's a good one or timing is right, we are going to reach out to these people and we'll get them on. So labs@chaosgroup.com is the place to go to get that information, or if you just want to give us feedback as well. But The best place to give us a review would be on Apple Podcast, and definitely let us know where you want to do that, and give us, you know, share us with your friends. But you know what? I was also thinking, we haven't been pushing people to give us a review on our Facebook page. And what was our Facebook page again, Kristen?
Facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast.
Great. So you can give us a rating on that page as well. And as well as the fact that, as you may know, these are now video podcasts, and they're available on Facebook, on our Facebook page. So you can check us out there. You can see Kristen and I talking. I'm in my lovely backyard. Kristen is in her lovely living room. You can check us out on there. And we're also available on YouTube if you want to check us out on that channel. And that's on our just a regular Chaos Group TV Facebook channel. So you can just go to YouTube, Chaos Group TV. All right. That being said, please enjoy this amazing podcast with our good friend Maciek.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I hope my daughter is not gonna run in. If she does,
you know, I'm actually recording this in my son's room.
I can see that
little.
See
my little artwork exactly. Here. And the reason is I'm actually facing, believe it or not, inside of his bunk bed, which is filled with stuffed animals. So it actually makes for excellent soundproofing.
The times we're living in.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Pretty good. But it sounds good. You sound great. So obviously I'm seeing by your microphone and your setup that you have been doing some podcasting yourself.
Yes, indeed. I've been running my podcast for quite a few years now.
Yeah.
But I'm not doing it like professionally. It's sort of like the side thing, because art and just art business in general is what I delve into the most, and podcast is just like, oh, it's an opportunity to talk with people, and you know, it could possibly make it bigger. I feel like if I put way more attention to it and do it more regularly, then yeah, but it's just like how many things you can do all at once, you know?
Yeah. I run two podcasts. So.
There you go. You
know, on top of, and it was just because the first one started off a little, although it was actually professionally, this one where we're doing now, it was more of an afterthought. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, what if we tried doing a podcast? And then it became more and more popular. So then I was like, I guess I have to spend more time doing this.
Right.
But then I enjoyed it. And so I made another podcast. It's like, well, this one, just one just for goofing around podcast. So that one is a different one. But anyway, okay. So let's before we go too far into this, I'm sure I tend to go all over the place a little bit,
and yeah, it's so
more
good
conversational.
I like the conversations to be as organic as possible. You know,
okay,
I was actually recording an episode with Alan McKay. I think you guys know each other.
We do.
Yeah. So he said I should say hi.
on his behalf.
So.
Great. Yeah. I know Alan. In fact, my episode with Alan just came out this week.
Oh, perfect. There you go.
And then he is going to, I'm going to record one with him as well. So we've actually, when he and I both started doing a podcast around the same time, which was 6 years ago. So.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, cool. It's fun. But let's see, how did, before you got into podcasting and everything else, obviously you're very well known for your art and your concept work. What inspired you? What's some of your origin story there? Let's get into that.
Ooh, that's a long one to talk about.
Okay. Well, We got time.
You know, I used to draw all the time when I was a kid. I think that's pretty much a story for most of the artists. Like, I used to be that kid that draws, you know, all the time. I remember, you know, my history, biology, and like all the classroom books, like the last few pages were just scribbles of, you know, from appropriate to very inappropriate stuff that usually boys do at that age.
Uh-huh.
And I would just draw a lot. And eventually, you know, there was couple of seminal moments in my life. I think that kind of directed me towards where I am right now.
Mm-hmm.
First of them, I think was the first of them was discovering role playing games, like, you know, Warhammer and Dungeons and Dragons, like all those, and then and having a group of friends that I would do it with.
And what? Okay, what year are we talking about?
Oh, I can't remember. I was a kid back then. I'm maybe like 10, 12 years old.
Okay.
When I discovered it all.
Yeah. And was this in the U.S. or where was
no,
it?
No, I'm originally from Poland. So Poland, like I grew right. up in like, you know, grew out from like grew up first tiny bit of my life in behind the Iron Curtain. And then like everything started rolling out. So by the time I was entering my teenage years, it was developed enough. So we started to see those things pop up, you know, VHS tapes with Van Damme movies and, you know, like all those things that we're always super interested about.
When I was a kid, I visited Europe. My mother's Hungarian. So I visited Hungary when it was still behind the Iron Curtain and then after, you know, so I know that the difference can be quite stark.
I'm sure
growing up, that was like seeing that change, right?
It was interesting because like the first year I remember like everyone was celebrating that we were, you know, quote unquote, out of communism. That was in 89.
Mm-hmm.
And we had like the first free elections in the country. And I remember everyone was like super excited and celebrating. And then there was like this basically 20 years of giant turmoil and like growing pains of democracy and getting out of that very corrupt system to, you know, to what it is now. Like, if I would look back at what Poland was back then and versus what it is now, it's just like, oh my God, the difference is just impossible.
Right.
There's just so much more opportunity and everything. And I haven't been in Poland for quite a few years, but even when I was getting out of there, like it was just different. So when I was growing up, when I was in my teenage years, like we had access to, you know, those things already, you know, the books and games and all those things. And I remember visiting my uncle in London. It was Huddersfield or somewhere like up north close to Leeds. We went like this road trip from my hometown all across the Europe with like regular maps, because that was the times where you wouldn't have GPS, so we would just drive for like almost 20 something hours straight, like using maps and getting lost here and there. And I remember like the first question they asked, do you guys have like color TVs? Like, yeah, we do. Like, come on. Like, you know, that was kind of funny. But yeah, like once those things started to pop up, then, you know, it definitely sparked my interest. So like all of those role-playing games, you know, from Warhammer to D&D, Cyberpunk, you know, you name it. There was like quite a few. And I had like a group of friends that I would play with, and we would just like always imagine, and eventually led to like, oh, it would be so cool to draw the characters we have, you know, and we would just like draw those characters, and, you know, those character sheets would have like little portraits and all that kind of cool stuff.
Yeah.
So that was
and
the
then
first.
You got a piece of new armor, so you got to draw them all over again. Right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. right. Yeah, you know it.
Used to play a little D&D.
There you go. And then, and from there, it was anime. So, like, when I saw Akira for the first time and when I saw Ghost in the Shell for the first time, because that was the time where the animation, like, the Western animation was sort of like, it's okay. Like, I guess the Batman series were pretty amazing, but they were...
The TV series, you mean?
TV series, yeah.
Yeah.
Still the best, in my opinion.
Voices
but they were
awesome too.
that opening sequence is just so classic. It's just so classic. But I remember, you know, most of the animations were kind of like not half-assed, but like not really that well drawn. Let's put it this. Oh, well drawn, but very stylized. So you would have quite a stylistically, they would be very simple. Let's put it this way. You wouldn't have this amazing amount of details in the background and this sort of like very realistic but yet cartoony kind of look, right? So when I watched the Ghost in the Shell and Acura for the first time, I was just blown away. Like, how on earth they did that, you know? Because everything looks realistic, but it's still a cartoon, quote-unquote, you know? And the animations were so fluid and smooth and so well executed. And it's, like, right up my alley with, like, the sci-fi, cyberpunk elements. It was like, oh, my God, you know?
I think it's because they did Parallax so well. It almost felt 3D. You know what I mean? The Parallax was so well executed that it felt 3D in a lot of ways. It was very interesting.
All those animations were mind-blowing. And then seeing, you know, Miyazaki movies in the theater, especially in the theater, like, oh, my God. Like, it's such an experience. I remember it till today, like it was yesterday, you know? I've seen, you know, I don't frequent movies that much. I've seen enough to know, like, to have an opinion how the movies are, but there are only a few that I really remember seeing and, like, being just so impacted by them, and, you know, seeing Miyazaki movies. And then recently I had a chance to in past few years to see Acura in the movie theater as well, instead of just, like, on the you know, computer screen and whatnot. So when I saw that, I was like, okay, that was, like, the second thing. And then the third thing was seeing Tomek Baginski's Cathedral. That was, like, the third big.
Which one was, like, that? Sorry.
So back, I think it was 2002 or 2003. Mm-hmm. It was a national news almost, because all of a sudden we have this Polish guy get nominated to Academy Award. And I know there's quite a few Polish people that were nominated. But to me, it was a big deal because it was, like, again, like, it was a short film, animated, and it was, like, in this very sort of, like, fantasy-wise world. And it looked like, oh, my God, it looks mind-blowing. Like, the whole idea behind it, you know, it reminded me of the paintings of Baczynski. And it was just like, wow. And so that was, like, the third moment where I saw that. And then I saw the making of, where I would see artists doing digital paintings and modeling stuff. And I was like, holy crap, like, this is so amazing. Like, I was never aware that this kind of world even exists. You know, that you have this myth of starving artists. So I'd never considered art as anything at all. It was just like, oh, it's my hobby. I just like drawing. But seeing that was like a pivotal moment, I would say, for realizing that there is an actual path that you can go and pursue.
But what was your path at that time? What were you planning on doing?
Oh, I had no idea what the hell I'm going to be doing. You know?
Right.
I was sort of like following the motions. You know, the idea was always, you know, parents would tell you, go to, like, the most prestigious school you can find and try to, you know, do the best out of it. And so I went to, like, this technical university in Gdańsk, which is, like, one of the most difficult, at least back then, was considered one of the most difficult ones. Easy to get to, but then, like, the first year you were like only 10% or 20% people would survive it and the rest would be kicked out. And so I went there and, like, I'm going to be, I guess, an electrician, you know, something like that. We'll see what's going to happen. And I would work, you know, after school, I would go and work. I couldn't find work, so I was working as a janitor. That was the only thing I could find. Wow. So I had, like, no idea what I'm going to do, you know. Like, most of my friends were like, oh, I'm just going to see what happens and maybe work in the shop or something, or, like, a service or whatever, you know. Those regular, you know, regular jobs, you know, dirty hand jobs, basically. That was my, okay, that's my life, that's where I'm going, you know. So having that moment to see where, crap, like, I'm doing this art thing and I can see that some people are actually making money doing that, that was just like a light bulb, you know, like, okay, you can do something here. So
then you said, all right, and then did you pursue a different education, or did you just basically start to self-teach yourself? What's going on?
Self-teach. Like, the only thing that was out there was Nomen DVDs. That was the only thing, and I was not able to afford any of them.
Yeah.
So obviously that's
I did the first Norman V-Ray DVDs.
So. Oh, there you go. I might have seen it actually. But honestly, I mean, you know, it wasn't like we had internet either, you know? Like I remember internet was just starting, you would have dial up. I think by the time I was in the university, we actually had like 128K or 256K. Which is now
ISDN
like,
lines or SDL or DSL lines? Or
yeah, DSL lines. Yeah, so like super slow. It was fast back then, like, but you know, all things considered, like you would not be watching HD videos. Let's just put it out there. You would have to download them for like half an hour just to watch one video. There was no YouTube. Yeah, no forum. Like, well, there was forums, right? So there was no YouTube, no social media, nothing. You would only know what people say on forums if you were lucky enough to find forums in the first place, and then once you found them, just, you know, word of mouth, basically. Mm-hmm. So I went on this Polish forums called max3dpl.pl, and then the second one I've discovered was Cijin. And that's where I discovered Craig Mullins and all of the other artists that were posting there as well. I mean, Craig Mullins basically made this forum big because of the speed painting thread. And then from there, basically, you know, all kind of domino effect to like, oh, conceptart.org, CG Talk before it was CG Society, CG Talk, you know?
Yeah.
CG Channel, like all of those places, and DeviantArt, and there was a few more. So I would try like register everywhere, see what people do, and ask questions all the time, and try to paint, and like, and you know, join those speed painting forums and try to speed paint and paint and do stuff. But again, none of that was in the effort to become an artist. It was more like I was obsessed about the idea that you can do digital paintings because I saw those guys at Platige Image doing the cathedral with Tomek Baginski, and I was like, wow, like I wish I could do something like that myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew you can make a career out of it, but it was just like, to me, it was so unobtainable back then because I looked at those guys, was like, those are such an amazing artists, and you know, I'm nowhere near that. Like I wasn't considering that maybe I have enough talent for it either, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it takes time. All of it takes time. So I would just paint, post, you know? And eventually, yeah, I got to a point where people would start reach out and say, like, first it was like some random person, like, hey, I just need like a painting for my friend. And like, what the hell? Like, are we doing that? And then like some other like small company, we need some paintings for this web game. You remember those Flash web games back then?
Oh yeah.
So like I would do quite a few of those actually. That was like my first like actual job. And then the big moment was another big moment, like where I knew, okay, this is where I can start making money actually, was when this German company, it was like this German, I can't even remember the name of the project and the game that they were making. But it was like a small company that they were doing like this tabletop railroad game with like weird creatures, and like it was like a rail. I think one was a railroad game, and the other one was like a creature card game, something like that, like a tabletop stuff similar to like Magic, but like way lower key.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I did that, that was like, okay, like I'm getting into territory where I'm making money that I would be making in the shop or even more, right? So maybe that's the way to go. So yeah, it kind of started there and went from there, basically.
Right. So being a janitor was not as
you
surpassed janitor salary at that point, right? Where you
my janitor my janitor salary was enough for me to buy my first tablet. That was like I saved for an entire month to buy this shitty $50 tablet. You know?
Right,
that was the extent of it. So, definitely helped my career. Being a janitor definitely helped my career.
You know, sometimes those $50 tablets become very, very emotional because.
Yeah, it was one of those pentagram with like a wire that was connected to a pen. The pen was like super heavy with the, like, it had a wire and batteries for no reason. I can't remember. It was like super inaccurate, like 5 levels of, you know, or 10 levels of pressure.
Yeah.
It was, yeah, it was terrible to work with. But that was like better than mouse, you know, like that was like super impressive. And I was like looking at, everyone's like, oh, Wacom is the jam. Go for Wacom. I was like, fuck no, I'm not going to spend like $200 on this. Like, I don't have that money, man.
Right.
So, but then I made that job and like literally I got the check and I spent it all on the Wacom, you know, like I got to get the high end, the best, you know, I got this larger one. Got like a computer from like a wholesale, you know, like when companies go bankrupt. And they get rid of the PCs, like office PCs, so I could actually work. You know, it was really, really interesting.
Still had some viruses left on it.
Probably, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, totally. So this was what, earliest 2000s or late
2002, 2001, 2002, 2003, something like that. Yeah.
All right. So now you figured out, it's like, I can start doing this. And then did it just snowball and from there and just kept going and going?
Pretty much. I was still, I applied to university. Mm. I was at my first year. So that was the craziest because the university was really, really stressful because we would have exams every week. And the idea was that if you have to have, I think it was somewhere of a threshold of 80%. Of 80% of right answers on all of your tests throughout the whole year in order to be eligible to do the final test of the semester so that you can move to the next semester. So it wasn't like you could cruise along and then do the tests and then you were good to go. You had to like pretty much go get all the homework and then prepare for a test for next week. And
if you drop so below 80%, you'd be kicked out basically, right?
Yeah, you would have an opportunity to go and correct those tests in like one go, like a week before a final exam. Mm-hmm. So it was like you would have to be like, you know, working your ass off to get it done.
Yep.
And I was in that situation where I was missing a few points and. Usually some of the professors would do it like you could go to their office and then like sort of like contest those missed points and they would ask you a few questions. If it's like, the reason was like if you made a genuine mistake on the test and they knew you know the answer, then they would correct it and allow you to go for a final exam. And if you didn't go for a final exam, you would have to start over basically, you know? So that's why the first year is like this sort of massacre of like, let's get everyone in and then kick everyone out.
Yeah, it was the same thing. My sister went to university in Belgium, and it was the same thing. It was the Free University of Belgium. I mean, basically, anyone can go. There's everyone is accepted. You want to become a lawyer? It's an excellent law school. You want to become a lawyer? Great. 90% of the people fail out right at the beginning.
Yeah, the first semester they're just like, oh, that's not for me.
Yeah,
there's no way.
Yep. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard.
So I remember.
But it gives everyone an opportunity. It gives everyone an opportunity, which is true.
I think the law schools and medical schools, you had to do a pre-exam. Those were like the ones where they're not accepting. But any engineering school would accept anyone who wanted to go, you know?
Right.
But they were considered. So like, I think law schools and medical schools were always considered the hardest. But like you would have to pass a certain threshold of score to go to like an economy classes in university, so it would be very difficult to get in. But then the whole process of being there wouldn't be as hardcore as if you would go to an engineering school, which was very easy to get in but very difficult to finish.
To finish.
Right. So I went the latter route, which was. Terrible.
Challenging.
challenging to say at least. But I remember I would wake up 4 a.m. and then walk to a train station for like 40 minutes and then take a train for another 45 minutes and then walk from train station to the classes for like 30 minutes. And so it would take me like about an hour. So somewhere between an hour and a half to 2 hours, depending if I was lucky. With catching the train, right? to get to the school, and then same deal going back. So I would leave my house like 5 a.m. on average and get back like 6, 7 p.m. And then I would have to prepare for exams. So I would just do my minimal just to get ready and then just paint. I didn't have like any life basically at that point. Right. It was just like any free time, I was just like obsessed about art and painting. No meetings with friends or whatever. So it was difficult. But yeah, once those jobs, like some of those jobs started to pop up when I was on my first semester, and then on my second semester, I got like another job that was actually, it made me from this person that is like, you know, I want to go for a beer with you guys, but I have no money, to like, I'm buying everyone beers, you know,
right.
That was to the extent. So it wasn't good money, but it was good enough for, you know, to like hang out with friends when I had time to do that. And what we would usually do is skip classes in order to do that, you know, because like once you're done, like we would always just, yeah, you gotta go home, get ready for exams and everything. So it was difficult, but yeah, I look at those times fondly for sure.
Yeah. Well, okay. So what allowed you to sort of, you know, did you stick with school, or did you after a while say, you know what, I'm having more fun doing this. I think I have another career and I don't need.
So the big change, like the big moment was towards the end. So when I was about towards the end of the second semester, and I was on the track of actually pass. I did pass all of the exams, which was crazy because I was so lucky. I went to one of those arbitration sessions with I think it was physics class, and my friends looked like, I think I was missing like 4 points, and all of them are like, what the hell are you doing here? Like, there's no way you're going to get those 4 points. And I got 4 points. got 4 points. Like, what the fuck? You're like the luckiest guy. Like, all right. Yeah. Kind of worked out. And then on the class, like on the exam itself, I was just allegedly, let's put it this way, sitting in the right position, and there was this guy who just like was always prepared, had all the answers, and it just so happened he was in the same group as I was, so I was like sure, for sure I'm not gonna pass this, because I had to prepare for like the arbitration and whatnot, and so I couldn't prepare for the exams, but he just so happened to be in the same group, exam group, and I knew. Yeah, I just looked at, like, he has all the answers. All I have to do is just Xerox that shit. And, like, everyone's super stressed out. I was, like, super chill. The exam results came in. I got, like, 90-something percent. I was like, fucking, wow. Let's go. So that was, like, super lucky to pass second semester. But that was at the same time where I had more of those smaller offers coming in. And then the two big ones came in. One was working for, it was a cinematic for Painkiller, the first Painkiller game.
Okay.
And I think they wanted some design, like some, it wasn't even painting. That was like a 3D stuff with 3ds Max. It was just like some kind of tomb with textures and whatnot. And then there was like a concept of one of the monsters. And it just so happened that the concept that I did for that monster, for one of the bosses, I think it was the bosses for the expansion. I had a friend who worked at that company, The People Can Fly, which was later bought by Epic Games, who I knew from the forums, from the Max 3D forums. And we would talk all the time. And that painting that I did for that cinematic went through, and Adrian Chmielasz, who was the CEO of People Can Fly at the time, he was like, I love this. Like, who is, like, I wonder who that guy is. And my friend was there. It's like, I know this guy. I got a phone call like right away. Like, hey, come to Warsaw and work with us. You know, we're going to pay you X and Y and Z. And I was like, holy fuck, I'm going to make 3 times more money than I would make as an electrician if I got an electrician job, you know?
Right.
So to me, it was like, I went to my mom's like, Mom, like I'm moving to Warsaw.
I'm gonna be an artist.
Wait, what happened? I'm gonna be an artist. And so yeah, it started from there. And then from there it was pretty much, you know, all uphill. Well, not uphill. Right. I mean, like just climbing the ladder. Let's put it this way. Because 5 months later, I would just like continue posting, but this time I basically dropped out. I went to the university office and like, I'm out, you know, and bye. Mm-hmm. Like, are you sure? Like, yeah, I'm sure. You passed all the exams. Like, yeah, fuck it. You know? You know, and then like my friends would call me like when the third semester started, they would be like, hey, you're still on the list, you know? Like, well, I don't care.
Wow.
So yeah, I would move to Warsaw, work there for a couple of months and then got offered to work at Crytek, and then it went from there.
Wow. That's pretty good. So Crytek, that must have been interesting. Was that in Poland as well?
No, Crytek was Germany. So when I joined Crytek, that was back in 2005.
Yeah.
So I went from telling my mom I'm moving out from home to Warsaw.
Right.
So I'll be like 200 miles away from home. Right. To I'm moving to Germany, will be 1,000 miles away from home, right, or whatever the amount, right?
Right.
And then she was like, what the hell? You know, but, you know, the pay was better. That was there was a few companies that I applied to when I was at People Can Fly, because People Can Fly was good, but I was always looking at, can I make it even better? Can I go higher? Can I go like EA Games or something, like Ubisoft? That would be cool, right, you know, like right, those right, really right, big recognizable brands.
Mm-hmm.
And Crytek caught my attention because they did Far Cry, and right, Far Cry was a big hit. So I was like, oh crap, like this is pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. So I applied and they haven't replied for, I think 3 months or something. And eventually they reached out like, hey, we're interested. Your work looks cool. We want to fly you in and interview. Like, nice. Holy crap, that's awesome. So nice. Went there. It was pretty awesome at the start because when I joined the company, they were still living in the offices were still in Coburg, which is like this small Bavarian town with the castle on the top of a hill.
Uh-huh.
You know, like typical picturesque German right, you know, small town, like 5,000, 6,000 people, like super small.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty cool. And then they moved to, I think a year and a half later, something like that, they moved to Frankfurt. So we moved to Frankfurt. I was at Crytek for like 4 years, I think, altogether.
Okay. You know? I mean, they were big, and it wasn't just their games. Far Cry was obviously a big one, but they had the Crytek engine. So they were really like movers and shakers in the game industry. So
it was interesting because what I was doing there within the concept team, there was a bunch of like really talented people working in the concept team, and they grew and then they shrank. I mean, the Crytek is not what it was anymore, unfortunately. But when we were working on Crysis, it was very interesting because we were not just doing concepts, but we were also working with programmers, the R&D department, and designers to basically, hey, how far can we push the realism? So we would just like feed them with ideas. Oh, we need like, you know, ambient occlusion, or like we would explain what we think about bounce lighting, and then mm-hmm. they would interpolate that into like, okay, how can we code it so it becomes right, this real-time thing. And they had the Crytek engine, like the Cry engine.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically like we were doing what people now are approaching with the Unreal Engine and using it for concept art. We were doing it back then in 2006.
Yeah.
Basically, like we would just me and a few of my friends in the concept department, we would just take the engine and start like kid bashing, you know, built elements into scenes and overpaint right, and paint over and like set up lighting and clouds, like the virtual clouds and whatever, so right, that the painting like would help the painting process. But it will also like, oh, this is the sandbox that the game designers can now, or level designers can now take and refine for what the design would right, be, you know.
Yeah, so you're starting inside of the game, in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. So wow, I was very fortunate to be like on the forefront of that, but yeah, like I was just like, I haven't looked at it too seriously for a long time. I guess it opened me up to use 3D a little more, because then I realized, oh, this is pretty powerful. Mm-hmm. It made me less shamed about using photography in art as well, and textures, because that was something that everyone was frowning upon. Like, if you used photos in your concept art back in 2006, you were the worst person. You know?
So, people do it all the time.
Yeah, they find those pet peeves. They find those moments where they can just like shame you for whatever reason. But yeah, so yeah, we would do that back then. And yeah, I mean, it kind of moved on from there. It was just, you know, again, it was a similar story with Naughty Dog. I had a friend who I knew for years that worked at Crytek. He left for Naughty Dog, and then some of the Christoph and Evan at Naughty Dog saw my work, mm-hmm. and they asked, who is that guy? And it just so happened my friend was there, and was like, that's my friend.
Mm-hmm.
Let's fly him in.
Right.
Very similar story with like, as with People Can Fly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what? So that's when you, I guess, when you came to the US is for Naughty Dog, right?
Yeah. 2010.
2010.
Yeah. Okay. I spent like, yeah, a good 4 years at Crytek.
4 years at, yeah. Crytek. Okay. And then yeah. And then Naughty Dog. So what were you working on at Naughty Dog?
The Last of Us.
The Last of Us. Okay.
Yeah. We did The Last of Us. I was like 100% convinced we're going to do another Uncharted.
Right.
Like, I was just like super excited. I even started like drawing Uncharted like sketches right before moving. It's like, hell right, yeah, right. You know, new adventure, you know. I'm coming over. It's like, oh, this is a completely different project, you know.
Right.
But it was fun. It was fun. I think it was career wise, the time I've spent working on The Last of Us opened my mind to what's possible the most, I would say.
Okay.
And it's mostly because the talent that I was involved with, like all the other illustrators like Shadi Safadi and mm-hmm. Eitan Zana joined later, and Aaron Lemonic and Hyung Nam was there. He was like, just, he's such an incredible, you know, character artist, character mm-hmm. Designer.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Kim and a bunch of other people. And then obviously...
was Frank Zhang on Bruce, there?
No, he joined a little later, I think. But the biggest part of it was working with Bruce Straley,
mm-hmm.
Who was the game director,
mm-hmm.
and because Bruce was art director on first Uncharted, I believe, first okay. and second, I think, and I think on the second one he was the game designer, not game designer, game director, on the second Uncharted, and then on the Last of Us, and what was really interesting to me and impressive was that he approached art from art director perspective, but then the construction from game designer perspective. So he was like a perfect bridge between those two worlds, you know, someone who completely understands art and the sensitivity of art and all the details that go into making something that's beautiful, and also like how it applies to game design and level design and everything. So it was like a perfect mixture of people in the right place, in the right spot. And again, very similar to what we did at Crytek, we are indeed a lot of what we were doing. So the idea was like, how can we make The Last of Us look different than Uncharted? Because it was all started on basically Uncharted backbones, right? Uncharted 2 backbones. So we'd have to like rework pretty much the how lighting works, how textures are made, like how the whole pipeline looks and works. A lot of battles, a lot of, you know, egos on all ends, including mine. And but it was a wonderful process where it just made me understand how a lot of effort can lead to amazing results if done in the right way. You know,
what way makes them work better?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what way would you say is the thing that the secret that makes it work better, the process?
Well, so I think the biggest lesson I've learned is that it's you have to put effort to make it good. Like, you cannot half-ass and just assume that you know the best and you know all the the whole recipe. You're part of the team, you know?
Right.
And you have to work as a team. And you have to look at what other people are saying and see if there's any merit in it. You know, you cannot just like assume like I am an artist, so I know better, you know, because right. like we would design something and then we would be shown like it's not fun to play, you know, like it looks great, but it's just like it's not fun.
Right.
So
right.
Why, we're not doing the game to look good. We're doing the game so it looks good and it's fun, you
right,
know?
Right. Yes.
So all those things matter. And like working with Bruce, for instance, like he always emphasized this idea that there has to be a pacing, the gameplay and the art has to be connected to the story. So it wouldn't be just a shelf, like the shell level, like the surface level of, hey, let's I'm just gonna concept something that looks really cool and call it a day and let them to figure it out, you know? Yeah. It would be always like, all right, how can this concept inform the rest of the team so they don't have to come back every 5 minutes and figure out what the hell I was trying to say in this illustration, you know? So sure. We would do like a lot of studies where we would figure out what's the best way to texture things and then make like really detailed illustration, but then also show that the world we're building is, you know, is very, the approach to like post-apocalyptic world is very different than you would see normally everywhere else where, hey, we can make this world beautiful. It doesn't have to be gray and brown, you know? That was just sort of like the approach of post-apocalyptic games and films back then, where I don't think there was any game that was like, hey, this is the post-apocalyptic world, but it's really colorful and beautiful, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we would look at how can that be expressed in most realistic way. So yeah, having those meetings and conversations back and forths, like a lot of teamwork to get things figured out. And a lot of arguments too. Like we would have to argue to find the best solution, you know?
Right.
And you grow a thick skin when that happens. You have to. Like you cannot just like, oh, I'm just like, I'm going to go to my corner and play with my own toys, you know? Like that's just not helping anyone. So.
No. It's interesting you learned it through that process because, you know, I learned that when I went to architecture school, like architecture had,
right.
You had to learn to design and have take feedback, you know,
yeah,
and not take it personally, right? Because, you know, a lot of times when you're an artist, it's like, I like it. I don't care if anyone else likes it or not. You know, it's like, but when you're designing a building, you have to like, it has to work for everyone, you know?
Exactly.
So it's an interesting idea that you get the same process from designing games. I mean, and that makes sense because you're designing a piece of architecture that functions in the game, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
It was very different environment also to any previous environments I worked with because every single person in the team had a say. Like, when I came to Naughty Dog, what they explained it to me was they said three things. One, everyone is equal, meaning, you know, if your idea is good, it's just a good idea and we'll discuss it. You know, it's not like you have to go through the chain of command in order to achieve anything. That was the first thing. So less structure, it was very flat. You would have leads to make sure that someone is heading at the
taking charge. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But it wasn't that person had like absolute say.
Right.
It was more like it has to be organized in a way, but everyone is equal in terms of like we can chip in. And if everyone agrees that's the great idea, then we go with that, you know?
Right.
And the second thing is like, oh, what is it like with the meetings? Like, we don't have meetings. We don't do meetings. The meeting is when you come over and you want to solve a problem, you know?
Okay.
And the third one was like, and that was also something that was pretty interesting to me is that the whole recruiting process, it took 7 months from the moment I started talking to the moment I was actually hired.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of back and forth. Hold on.
That usually is because they're going to hire you.
Coming in.
That's because they're probably going to hire you for a longer term, right?
Yeah. So the way the process was, they wanted to make sure that they are hiring a person that can take a charge, take matters in your own hands. And they said, like, don't wait for a meeting. If you need to solve something, go to a desk of a person that will help you to solve the problem. Otherwise, it, like, it's going to be weird, you know? You're going to be sitting there and doing nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not going to micromanage your, like, every day, basically, so.
Right.
So that was very weird because, like, at Crytek, it was completely different. We would have scheduled meetings, structure, right. Almost like a, you know, very structured environment, like most of the studios run. So mm-hmm. It was like a very different change. And I remember I my first 2 weeks, I was freaking out at the company because no one was talking to me. Like, I was just like, what am I supposed to do next? You know, like that was like a wake up thing.
I can imagine. Yeah.
But they were pretty chill. They said, like, look, like, we understand, you know, you're going to need a few weeks to, you know, accommodate to what's going on and like the process. Mm-hmm. But always, like, if you run yourself into a problem, just always come in and ask. You know, that's all we ask, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Come over and ask, and yeah, let's get things going. And so instead of like finishing work, for instance, like that's the usual process. You finish work and then you wait for your, you know, you send it feedback, out and wait for feedback. Yeah.
Yep.
So instead of that, it'll be like, no, I actually have to go and make sure that they see it and they give me feedback. You know, like.
Right.
So I don't wait for no reason, you know?
Yeah, it's much more active, less passive, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Get out of here.
That's okay.
My daughter is like just running crazy right now.
She's having a good time. That's good. No, listen, yeah, we're all working for
Yeah,
her.
We're all
So, that's okay, just, so
yeah.
So how long were you at Naughty Dog? And obviously you've done some other things besides games as well, right?
Right. So Naughty Dog was 2010, 2014 when I left.
Okay.
And I left, the reason I left, I love the company. I love the company. I love the guys that I was working with. I made a lot of good friends over there.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had an opportunity to work on Ghost in the Shell, basically. So I was like, kind of past that one, you know? Yeah,
right. And then, you know, after you were talking about Akira and Ghost in the Shell before.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was
the main reason to leave. Yeah.
Okay.
And also just like, you know, in 2012 mm-hmm. is when I started getting film offers too, like working with film directors and production designers, doing it on the side. I had this period of time where I went back to Poland for a year. Because mm-hmm. I was like, maybe coming back to Poland is the right way to go. You know, less taxes, cheaper life. You know, I can still work from home. Like, no visa issues. I could actually do work. You know, those mm-hmm. kind of things. So, yeah, there she's super loud.
it's not that loud from my side.
No, it's all good. I deal with this every day.
How old's your daughter?
She's five.
Okay, there you go.
She's pretty respectful when it comes to like understanding the boundaries of like daddy's working, but like so there's just some days when she's like, I don't give a crap. It's just gonna come in. That's funny. No, but you know, I've started having those offers, the film offers. So film also has like a different rates, and you know, when you're freelancing, then you realize, oh, I can make more money doing this. So there's like many, many layers to it. But the main reason for me was Ghost in the Shell. It's like, no, I cannot pass that opportunity, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, might as well just try myself and do something else and see if it works out. I left on a pretty good, you know,
good terms.
Yeah. They, mm-hmm. you know, I think I mean, I am not sure now, but like if a year later I would reach out to Evan and Christoph, say like, man, I'm missing you guys. They would be like, yeah, come back.
Right.
Pretty sure about that. So,
I mean, you always hope that that's the case, but it always feels good when you leave a place that's been, you know, that's the way it is communicated. So,
yeah. And they knew, you know, like when I was talking with them, when I was leaving, I said, like, look, guys, you know, I just cannot pass, like, I grew up on this shit. I just have to do it. You know, this mm-hmm. is like a once in a lifetime opportunity for me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try it, you know, see what happens. And it was good. It was good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the work is amazing. The work is amazing for sure. Well, I want to talk a little bit about, obviously, you know, you started basically, you're freelancing now and you started your own company that you do your freelancing under. Is that basically how you're working, or you have a
eventually company? I did my LLC incorporation. That's pretty standard for anyone who lives in America and doesn't have LLC and work as a freelancer. I don't know what the hell you're doing.
Yeah. So you did that, and then you started working stuff. Now you did do something. Obviously, you know. I mean, I've seen your work before, but I think one of the things is like why you should talk to Maciek and put him on the podcast is when you saw that Showtime thing you did. So explain that one, because obviously, again, that's you, after just hearing all of your past and where you came from is like
right.
Now I know how that came about, but let's explain what it was and what it's, you know, what you intended to be and how it worked for you.
Well, it all started, I mean, obviously anime fan and, you know, growing up on anime and mangas, and all that stuff that basically was always somewhere in the back of my head.
Yeah.
You know, I was always like a giant fan of Otomo Katsuhiro's work. Like, I was to me, hands down, the best.
Right.
Out there, you know, in terms of like how it's drawn, how it's executed, like everything. So, yeah, there you go. So, what I wanted to do is like, you know, like pretty much most of my career, I was trying to achieve this realistic results as far as I could, right?
Okay.
So I would paint and use 3D and, you know, use rendering and, you know, just to speed up the process or make the process easier, but basically reach that goal where my painting looks like super realistic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what actually got me into film industry, just the fact that I was able to produce illustrations that were very realistic in terms of how they were lit and presented as a, you know, almost like a keyframe, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now you did a lot of 3D as well though, right?
Eventually, yes. I mean, right now, for sure, right?
Right.
Back then, back in 2012, where I was starting, not so much. It was more of like painting, but it was just sprinkling a little bit of like 3D here and there, basically, right? So I did that, and I think I've reached the point where it's like, yeah, I can push it even further, make the scenes more complex and whatnot. But the problem with that is, it's just like, I'm kind of in one spot at this point and everyone else is getting to that spot as well. That was my logic behind it too, right? I would look at the work that people are producing. There's some amazing artists coming up with like super realistic looking work, great stuff. And I was like, I want to try something different. Like I want to try something I've never tried.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, why not just see if I can do like this kind of manga style characters and paintings just for a change, you know, see if that kind of jives with me. And it did. Like I started drawing those two characters, the bomber jacket girls, that's I call them. And you know, it started from like a simple drawing of one character, and then I did a drawing of two characters in like a, you know, so like quasi sci-fi environment, like on a staircase.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just went from there. It just like started doing those, okay, how far I can push it to where I'm like, I feel confident that this is like something fresh, you know, something that you can see and relate to the original manga, like the drawings of Katsuhiro and Nihei and all of those guys, versus what I'm doing and sort of like giving it my own kuchara twist, let's put it this way.
Right. Right.
Like this sort of mixture of Western and Eastern, let's put it this way. So I tried that, and then it led to, okay, how much of this could be done in 3D? Like, that would be interesting. Hey, if I can make those characters in 3D and figure out shading and whatnot. And that was when I actually was more getting deeper into using V-Ray. I think the V-Ray 3 was the point where you wouldn't have to have a calculator to to render anything.
Yep.
So
that's probably about right.
Yeah.
I'm glad you said that, because some people still think they need a calculator and they feel proud that they need the calculator.
Yeah. Now it's much easier. So I started setting up renders, see how they look, and you know.
And I guess you were playing with a non-photoreal cartoon shading, right?
Yeah. And just playing around with what's possible in Max and V-Ray, basically.
Right.
And obviously, like at start, it would be, you know, base stuff and then overpaints and like just bringing it to Photoshop and then later to Clip Studio Paint and working that way. And I got some bunch of like really good illustrations that I felt really happy with.
Right.
And then there was this one moment where I think I was doing Twitch stream with Ash Torp. That was by the time when we was shortly, it wasn't too long after we started Learn Squared, mm-hmm. when we did Twitch stream, and I was like, I'm just going to paint this character, but in color. I want to do this like very sort of Akira vibe, you know, painting and see how it looks. And that kind of sparked this idea. What if this whole thing was in color, you know, and had like this anime looking shader.
Right.
So it was almost like a 3 years journey, 3-4 years journey of like gradually just adding more question marks after each painting.
So it's like a continuous doodle for 3 years.
Yeah. And eventually, you know, it led to a point where I basically sort of jerry-rigged this shader in Max with V-Ray. And yeah. I tried everything. I tried like Octane, and Octane had its own like tune shading, and Redshift has its tune shading, and Arnold, like those work great, but the out of the box solution just never worked, you know?
Yeah. So it wasn't as good as what you wanted right away, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I did some tests. I posted them. People were like, what the hell? You know, like mm-hmm. the reaction was great. And I was like, crap, like this is looking pretty cool. Like, what if it was animated? So it was like the final straw. So this final question, what if it was animated?
Now, you're not much of an animator though, right?
Not at all. Not at all.
Because I noticed it. Did you animate a lot of it?
Showtime?
Yeah.
I mean, pretty much everything, right? Like everything that's there.
So that's the thing that everyone, you know, I looked at it and I'm like, I kind of know your work is like, and it's like, wow, look at that. And it's like, he's not really an animator, but he figured out the solution of how to, because there's very minimal animation that's being done by design, and it looks awesome, and it looks very anime, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it also gets you out of animating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I was cutting corners where I could.
But that's really good though, because what it does is that you strengthen the style by doing so. And you do, you know, like I think probably the most complex shot was the boot going down. Like there was a boot shot that was there, I think.
Yeah.
But even her, like even her on the elevator, like the only thing moving is her hair, basically.
Yeah, and her eyes. That's
her eyes. But you convey so much emotion through that it looks like really good animation, right?
And you know what? I will tell you why I think this works personally. This is very subjective. I guess Ghost in the Shell and Akira are probably not the best examples because some of the animations are so crazy.
Yeah.
That you're just like scratching your head, how the hell they did that. But mm-hmm. then they do quite a few shots where they feel very powerful, very dynamic, but there's not much going on. Like if you really examine the animations, there's just not really much going on there. Like it's a figure standing, maybe they're moving an arm, or there's a lot of, like you mentioned this, there's a lot of parallax movements that make the shots really feel dynamic.
Right.
And so to me it was like, if I can get away without exposing myself as an absolute, you know, fraud when it comes to an animation,
right?
Then, you know, then great. Then let's do that. And also, I think the way I was looking at it was, I want to do a short that will not destroy me in terms of my time commitment and everything. It still did, but not completely like destroy, you know. Because in order to do things like, okay, let's do a full-blown animation with dialogue and everything, like you're getting into a realm of rigging, UVing, like all of those things, right?
Lip-syncing.
Yeah, everything. And that's just so much. That's mm-hmm. just so much work.
Yeah.
Just to get prepared.
If you had to do dialogue, I'm just thinking about it. If you had to do some dialogue and you had to do lip-syncing movement, knowing how much you know, you'd probably spend almost 3 times as much time just to try to get that dialogue thing working, and it's not necessarily worth it, right?
Right. And you now would have maybe 2 extra shots that would have that, and it would cost me twice as much time to get it done, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, in the hindsight, if I wanted to do an animation like Showtime with an actual like character animation, maybe character combat or whatever that would be, where you see an actual animation and dialogue, mm-hmm. I would not do it myself. I would get someone who is like really professional and do it for me.
Right.
Yeah. Because otherwise, it's just like, yeah, I can be one-man orchestra. Like, I'm pretty sure I could learn it, but,
right.
but what's the point, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think those are really great choices. You know, like those are the choices that you make to heighten the strengths that you have and
right.
not really worry about the ones you don't have. And eventually, maybe you will. Maybe you will become an animator, or maybe you want to do that, or, you know,
who knows?
You want to do that. If you want to do that, right? But you'll do that on your own terms and when you want to do it, right? As opposed
right.
to
yeah.
doing it the other way. But I think it's fabulous. I think it's a really great piece.
Thank
and
you.
Obviously, you know, my since my daughter is 14 and she has really gotten into anime recently, she calls herself a complete weeb, and in fact, today I said finally, okay, fine, we're signing up for Crunchyroll. It's good. We got it. So now my son, who's 10, he's really getting into anime as well and stuff. So anyway, I showed him the Showtime piece and I showed it to them and saw what they think. And she was like, it's really cool. She goes, it's almost too detailed for an anime. It's almost got too much beauty in it. Like and I was like, it's like, okay. It says, what about the action? And how about the feeling? She goes, oh, yeah, nailed it. Now, obviously, a lot of what the power of it, and I know you know this, but it's in the sound design as well. The sound design
yeah.
is really powerful. How did that come about?
So I had an idea to use. So there's two layers to it. There's a track and
yes.
the sound design.
Mm-hmm.
So the track was basically Carpenter Brut's Frank's track.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Invasion AD.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first one, and I had a chance to talk with Frank because we're thinking about maybe doing something together
mm-hmm.
eventually, and so I had a contact with him. So
mm-hmm.
I was like, why don't just ask, you know, see if he's okay with that. So I asked, and he's like, yeah, that would be cool. So I licensed the track to make sure I can use it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one. And the second one was Pilot Priest,
mm-hmm.
who helped me with the sound design. I think without the sound design, it was pretty good, short.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it was did not have that punch.
No. Yeah, there was
yeah,
a
he
lot
just,
of fine sound design on there.
He is the best, yeah.
Yeah.
He is the best.
And it everywhere from very subtle to way over the top, like not over the top, but like really powerful, right? So you felt
yeah.
all the excitement and everything else, but it was just like ding, like even just the sound of the elevator beeping and the bzzz buzzing and the everything. So it was really,
there's just
really
so many tiny little layers that
there's a lot of layers
you can barely hear, but once you like really pay attention,
yep.
He sent me maybe I'll release that eventually, but he sent me the short. Without the music, with just the sound design. Obviously,
yeah.
like with the editing, there's some places where it's just like makes little sense because there are
mm-hmm.
they are cut specifically for the track, right?
Right.
But you listen to it, it's like holy crap! You know, it's just like there's so much going on. There's so
yep.
much awesome like little dings and like the rattling of the elevator and like this little. You know, it almost feel like you are in the elevator because like it just muffles when you're going in,
right?
And then you have the sort of like city buzz when you're outside. It's just like and the way it transitions. Yeah, I'm super happy with having Anthony on board. Yeah,
that's awesome. Well, what's your goal? I mean, you created this thing. You know, like you said, it almost felt like it started like a doodle that went on for 3 years and turned into an animation. But is it something you want? You have a bigger dreams or bigger ideas? You have this idea plotted out for yourself?
Right. So the first and foremost, the first thing I wanted to achieve with this is to see if I can direct an animation.
Wow.
If I can make one and direct one, you know? If I can just
okay.
pull it all together, because I, you know, it's one thing when you're doing a shot, right? You're like doing a shot, like one shot. When you're
mm-hmm.
animating, putting things together and making it look beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Once it goes into editing, and you have to edit and plan ahead, and start to like storyboard and basically make the whole pipeline of what the short is going to be. Mm-hmm. That's basically a replica of if you ever decided to work on the commercial or ever decided to direct anything, you have to go through the same process no matter what. Like it's going to be different scale, obviously. Like if you're designing something that's longer, that's going to mean there's more storyboard, there's more storytelling to be told. There's something that you might have to write, you know, you might consider having a track, not having a track, cutting to track, or getting a music design specifically for your shot. And so I wanted to see if this is something I can pull off personally, because, you know, my friend Ash, like I always admired, the one thing I was always admiring is that he was able to do all those short films he did so far and pull them off in pretty short amount of time. Like the Akira tribute he did was just mind blowing. So I looked at that. I was like, okay, you know, I want to see if I can do this myself. And I'm glad to have him as a friend, because I call him the best and the worst friend to have, because he's super, not aggressive, super difficult at times, meaning like he the expectations he has for himself is the same expectations he would have for you if you allow him, or if you show him that you have a goal like that, right? So he saw like, oh, you want to do a short film? Okay, all right, I'll make sure you do it, you know? So he was a whip. It's like, stop being a little bitch, just do it.
right.
So, and he helped me along the way just to figure things out. Like, because for instance, like when I started animating and putting things together and putting like the Rip-O-Matic and the animatic for my short, it was 3 minutes long.
Right.
And he's like, you're never going to finish this, you know, like you're working alone. Like, even if you get some help, this is going to take you forever. Do a minute, you know, do a minute. And prove yourself you can do it, you know?
Right.
I was like, oh, a minute's not enough. And eventually did a minute and 10. And I was like, oh, I wish I did 30 seconds.
Well, how long did it take? Okay, so once you decided you were going to do the animation, or you told Ash I'm going to do it, how long did it take you from that process to finish this?
Well, considering I work full time and have family and do a podcast and all those things combined, like you cannot work full time on the film like that. You have to do it like at nights.
Yeah.
But from start to finish was almost
a little over a year.
Yeah. And I've seen a lot of projects done similarly, but without having those moments. Cause like last 4 months, I would basically work all night, every night, all night, you know, and just plow through all the shots and make sure that it's done and not allow it to be good enough. You know, good enough was not good enough. It had to be perfect.
Right.
And that's maybe something that is wrong with me, where like every single frame has to be a screenshot, you know, but it also allowed me to understand where the limits are. And what are my limits, and how far I can push it, and where I'm going to hate it, and how much I'm going to want to quit it. All those things all combined. And so proving that I can do it was big, you know. I wasn't necessarily thinking about planning anything afterwards when I was making it. And honestly, you know, one of the things that I think, maybe I'm subjective about this, but some of the friends that did short films before, they said something similar, where once you release it, you're like, oh, I'm fucking so happy it's over. I don't even care what the reaction is, you know? So that was my like initial, yeah, I'm so happy it's over. I don't have to, you know, think about showtime anymore. And I do have some plans. We'll see how it goes. Obviously too early to talk about. We'll see how it goes. I don't think I have anything in plans where like, oh, this has to be a Hollywood production or anything like that. I don't think that's the way I would personally want to go with.
Right.
I think that we live in the world where the opportunities allow you to go different routes stuff like that. But I'll tell you, even before I finished and released it, I already got traction on things that kind of like sprung from the production of Showtime.
I'm sure.
Which was like, okay, this is already paying off, even though I'm
you
doing it for
released
free.
It. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
So that's definitely, yeah. It brought a pride of achieving something that I never thought I would be able to achieve. It opened doors to me where I know I can create something just bigger than concept, you know?
Right.
So I think those two are like the biggest achievements related to it. Everything else, you know, I look at it as a icing on the cake, you know? Right. I don't particularly care if people like it or not. Although reading through comments, it seems like the reception is pretty good.
Yep, people like it. For sure.
Yeah, so pretty proud of it. Yeah, I'm not going to lie.
You should be. Yeah, it's really, really great piece. And I think it's very telling of how it came from. And I really love, you know, like hearing all the stories from you, like what inspired you. And like, well, here you go. Here, like I feel it feels like you had to go through this whole journey to start getting to the point now that it all kind of comes together. And now you're like, now I can make this thing that I've been
passionate
about.
And you know, I mentioned when I was a Naughty Dog where, you know, this sort of like the experience of challenge, you know, like challenging yourself for the teamwork and challenging your ego and challenging, you know, once all of those things happened and then the game was released, it was a completely different experience in terms of like appreciation.
How's that?
Versus if everything was smooth and nice and easy and the game was released and they were like, oh, it was okay, you know? I think that's at least for me personally, is the more challenging the thing is and the more I want to quit doing something, the more I feel happy about when it's done and
I
proud
could not
of it.
Agree with you more. Yeah. I remember I was a VFX, it was one of my first big VFX supervisor jobs as in a commercial, and I was working at a company called Sway, and we were doing, actually one of my compositors, his name was Maciek as well, and I was working with this director, and it was a Subaru spot that we were working on, and it was a challenge, and it was really hard, and there was a lot of weird ideas, and the director had never worked on a full, and it was a full CG, and the director had never worked on a full CG spot before, and so I was working with him, we're trying to figure things out, and it was tough, and we were challenging each other, there was yelling matches going on, not yelling matches, but disagreements, shall we say, and it all happened, and then when we came out, it was really good. My executive producer said, well, there's another bid for another commercial that came in with the same director, but I don't think you want to work with him. And I said, why? And then he goes, well, you were always fighting with him. I said, well, that's how we came up with such a great commercial. it's like creativity comes out of struggle, you know? And I think he and I would agree that if we are like, looks great, moving on, then like we never challenged it to look better, you know what I mean? And I think you need to have those disagreements for it to look better. And when things go really smoothly, you get an okay product.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you don't get anything
great.
But I think it's that struggle. And so, and in fact, it was. You know, we got nominated for a VS award for it. We got a bunch of things, and so it really did really well. But it's, you have to have those struggles. You have to have that conflict, because if you don't have a conflict, if you just go, it looks good, it's okay. If you have a conflict, then it's going to automatically be better.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, like you have to push. Sometimes I ask myself, like, is it even worth? Because like, you could argue that, you know, who's gonna come through the whole thing with the magnifying glass and see if there's an error in the frame, you know?
Yeah.
And if it's gonna look good. But I will, you know.
Yeah,
it's, I think it just comes down to that obsession. No, but I agree, like 100%. The more you struggle with something, the more happiness you get out of it later on, you know?
There was I went to architecture school, an architecture professor, and I was making a model, and he was a perfectionist. Like he was, actually, he's been on my podcast. His name is David Guthrie, but he was like, I was doing these things and I was making a model and everything. And I had this wall, you know, it was, we were using basswood at the time, and a wall like this, and I had some glue, and there was a little bit of glue on the thing. And I said, well, I'm not gonna worry about that, 'cause it's going to be hidden. He goes, you'll know it's there. and I hated him for saying it, because I was like, yeah, now from now on, I have to fix it. 'Cause if I just put it on top and it's behind everything, now I got to fix it. 'Cause yeah. Even though I'll never see it, I'll know it's there.
do you feel that this kind of obsession is like among most of the artists, or only on like certain?
I think it depends on the kind of artist you are. Yeah, definitely right. Different kind of personality. Yeah.
Right.
'Cause my math background made things a lot more like had to be right. Certain precision, I think, is what I'm looking for. Right. It's harder for me to just be let loose. Right. And it was I was doing math and art at the same time. And like my art teacher took away my, you know, very hard, you know, H4 pencil, grabbed it out of my hand and shoved a big piece of charcoal in my hand, and, like, forced me to draw with charcoal just so that I could not, you know, sit down there and do all those precision drawings. So yeah, it was a big deal. Yeah, I think that's the kind of person you are, you know, and that's a good thing.
Yeah. I sometimes think to myself, like, oh, I'm kind of jealous to those who are like, oh, this is good enough and we can move on, because yeah, it's one of those things where you set up a render, or you finish the shot, or you finish the painting, and you cannot sleep because there's like this one, like that glue piece you're talking about that is stuck there, and you haven't fixed that. And your brain is just like, nope, fuck you. You're not sleeping tonight. You better fix that.
I have learned to let go a little bit of that, because I've also seen how bad that can get.
Oh yeah. You need an anchor.
Yeah. I mean, I saw things on some of the movies I worked on some of the Trons and stuff like that. It's like, dude, it's not worth it, right? I had some shots that went to 130 versions over 6 months for one shot. it's not
crazy.
Worth it. You know, it's not worth it. So there's reasons for that as well. And some people are like, they love that. They actually look at that version number and they're like, look how much better this is. I'm like, it's not better. It's excessive.
Yeah, I wonder how much of it is just like, yeah, it's like, oh, we did more versions, meaning it's better, you know, versus like objectively looking at the shots. Like, is it really better?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you do many versions and you come back to the first one like, the first one was always the best, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Couldn't agree
it's
more.
You know, the thing people have been joking about, I've been fishing lately, and I've become completely obsessed about fishing. and so I'll use another fishing analogy. When you're fishing a new spot, your first cast is always the best chance at catching a fish, because that's when the water is fresh. No one's been spooked. You haven't done anything, right?
Right.
And so your first cast is your best opportunity. And after that, you can try again better or whatever, but that first one is always your first, you know, it's what brought you there in the first place. So, I think that sometimes your first drawing or your first impulse is the one that you should always keep remembering, that that's what got you there.
Do you find yourself like obsessing about fishing? Like you obsess about CG?
100%. Wait, it's worse now than ever.
Oh no.
It's really bad.
Yeah, see, that's the kind of personality, right? Because I have, you know, I have a similar. I'm on purpose treating certain aspects of my life easy, and remind myself I'm already pretty good at one thing. I don't need to prove myself to be pretty good at other things, you know.
Right.
So, like recently, I started mountain biking, and you know, that's where like you could compare it to like CG, you know, like. When you start, you're on that sort of sticks figures level. Mm-hmm. And then you watch the videos of like some riders going really fast on like downhill trails. And
oh, yeah.
And
then you want to get like, there, right?
Oh, my God. They're so fast. But then you realize like, oh, those are like, you know, like a random CG artist from ArtStation. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the pro racers and like the Red Bull Rampage and RockShox events, and you're like, holy crap, they're like the Vitalis of, you know, of mountain biking, you know. And you can obsess about timing and, you know, clearing sections and clearing the climb and all those things. And I remind myself, wait a minute, I'm doing it for health and also just to have fun, you know, like I don't have to be like the best at it. So
I'm doing it so that I can clear my mind of other things. Like,
yeah, but then your brain goes and doesn't allow you.
Well, I'm trying to do it like, okay, so I'm not sitting in front of a computer, right?
Or all right, yeah, right, sure.
So I'm getting out, and you know, also I get up very, very early in the morning, you know, sunrise, and I drive from Burbank to Malibu, and you know, just as the sun is rising, and I'm fishing on a beach. Now that's my ultimate form of meditation, right?
Right, right.
So it's like, you know, this is a thing. Plus I'm doing it through fly fishing, which is a much bigger challenge.
Got it.
And you know, I'm tying my own flies. I'm doing it goes down the rabbit hole of obsessive and behavior, which is natural for people like us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least there's something meditative about it though, right? Like, yes, you're not in front of a computer and you know, you can, there's nothing on the line, like livelihood wise where you're like, I can just chill, you know, like I don't have to go aggro about everything. And if I don't catch fish,
you don't have to do that. But you think that, right? But you know that feeling when you said you're lying asleep and you're thinking about that animation,
right?
And you just want to fix that piece of hair. So I find myself sometimes like in a situation where I'm walking and I'm thinking about tying a fly where I want to put the feather here instead of here. And like, what would that do to the action of the fly? Like, so it's the same thing. My brain still does the same thing. You know?
Obsessive approach to everything.
Yeah. All right, sorry, we don't need to get down a rabbit hole, and it's you know, it's late on Friday, and I want to obviously give you the long weekend, but thank you so much for doing this. This has been amazing. I know that we're going to try to reach out to you, do a little you know, an article about you on our
yep,
site, which would be great.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, Henry's going to be very excited about that, but we'll have this podcast and we can put those two things together, which will be cool.
Sick.
Yeah, man, I think it's really great to see your work. And anytime you have anything new that you're doing, or if you want an idea, if you have an idea of something you want to do in V-Ray and is like, I don't know if this is possible, I'm the guy who will help make that happen.
Nice.
So you let
That's
me know.
Good. That's good. That's good. That's good. That's good to
let know.
Me know. There's certain right. pet peeves I have with V-Ray. It's like, guys,
tell me,
fix
tell
that
me.
Shit. Fix that
tell
shit.
Me. Tell me, I can be your sounding board for sure.
But I'll tell you, yeah, I mean, ever since I started using V-Ray, I don't want to be like I never do it where I'm like, oh, pay me, I can do it. It's like I never approach software or things that I'm interested about. Mm-hmm. But to me, V-Ray was like one of those things where it's like, yeah, it's definitely like a big boys game, you know?
Right.
At this point, yeah, we're in the big leagues when nice. Using V-Ray, and I've always, I don't, you know, honestly, you know, I'm pretty sure I would figure out the way to do Showtime otherwise, but it would probably take me much more time and maybe right. different approaches and different efforts versus having this software that does so much for you if you set it up correctly, you know, because it's all about right. like how you artistically play with it. And I feel like it's the only one right now that gives me that, you know, that extra edge where, okay, in combination, because nothing is just one thing, right? It's always a combination of different things altogether. But if you can art direct something in one software and you know it's just in conjunction with your pipeline will get you the results you want, that's all you could wish for, you know? So, and that's what it was for this project, so... Yeah.
Nice.
I really awesome. Appreciate having that. So,
well, happy that you're able to do that. That's really great. And the results speak for themselves. So,
thank you.
So, thanks, man.
I appreciate it.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate
yeah,
your time.
Thank you for the invite. Yeah, it was fun. Mm-hmm.